at 10 p.m. All dates and times are available at www.arttheater.coop/full-schedule. Today's Disability Beat is sponsored by our community partner, Jet's Pizza. Jet's uses only premium ingredients, including dough made freshly. Jet's Pizza stores are located at 512 South Neal Street in Champaign. Their number 217-352-3333 and 1907 West Springfield Avenue, 217-352-9992. You can order online at jetspizza.com. Also, Disability Beat is sponsored in part by attorney Baku Patel of Patel Law, who practices Social Security disability law and represents those who have been denied benefits. There are no fees unless Patel Law wins your case. You can contact Patel Law at 217-384-1111 for a free consultation to discuss your Social Security disability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana, with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is George Seaver from the Illinois State Comptroller's Office. You're listening to Disability Beat on WEFT, Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with attorney Kenneth Dickowski discussing guardianship for those who are elderly and people with developmental disabilities. But first, disability news. Voicing her dismay in a case causing an uproar among parents, a California judge last week strongly encouraged the parents of a boy with autism and their neighbors, who claim the boy is a public nuisance, and filed suit to enter a court-supervised mediation. In the end, both sides agreed to avert a trial and try to settle the lawsuit filed by Kumaran Sanatham and Bindu Potham and Robert and Marcy Flowers against Vidyut Gopal and Parul Agriway. After the hearing, Gopal said he was pleased with the judge's suggestion, noting that prior private mediation had been tried but failed. Robert Flowers called the judge's idea promising. Flowers said, quote, "We have been absolutely in favor of a solution since long before the suit ever happened." End quote. Sanatham said he was happy the judge, quote, "has given us the opportunity that we had been seeking since the beginning," end quote, while his wife added, quote, "We are looking forward to arriving at a permanent safety solution for all our children. That has always been our primary goal," end quote. The plaintiffs are seeking unspecified financial damages for the harm they say the situation caused them and want a plan in place that would protect the neighborhood's children. Though Gopal and Agriway have since moved, they own the home and could always return. However, they say that they do not intend to live on Arlington Court, the home of their previous neighborhood. The Flowers, who were renting the Sunnyvale home, also have moved. In their lawsuit filed last summer, Sanatham and Potham and the Flowers say that despite repeated appeals by residents in the neighborhood, the parents of the boy with autism had not been able to control his aggressive behavior toward others. The couple say that Gopal and Agriway's son would slap or kick their children and in at least one instance bit an adult who lived across the street from the boy. The two couples said Gopal and Agriway did not supervise their son well enough over the years and that their mounting frustration, after mounting frustration and an attempt to create a neighborhood safety plan in the spring of 2014, that fell apart, they were forced to sue. The couples have insisted that the lawsuit is not about the autism, but about public safety. Jill Escher, president of the San Francisco Bay Area Autism Society, whose members have been outraged over the lawsuit's aim of labeling the boy a public nuisance and their claim that his behavior would reduce property values, was relieved by the judge's advice to the parents and their decision to accept it. Said Escher, quote, the judge was trying to send a message that neighbors need to find ways to work things out without aggressive, expensive lawsuits like this one, said Escher. Many students receiving special education services are supported by one-on-one aides, but new research suggests these assistants may not be pulling their weight. A study looked at how one-on-ones spend their time in nearly 4 dozen autism support classrooms, and that finds that paraprofessionals are engaged in instruction or support just 57% of the time. By contrast, teachers were engaged in such activities 98% of the time, while classroom assistants were involved 91% of the time. Wrote researchers from the University of Pennsylvania, University of Washington, and the University of California, Riverside in their findings published online this month in the journal Teacher Education and Special Education, quote, the low rate of one-to-one assistance engagement suggests an inefficient use of an important resource, end quote. The findings are significant, researchers said, because one-to-ones are the fastest-growing group of special education staffers. Researchers said the relatively low level of involvement among one-to-ones could be a sign that they are poorly trained on how to work with students or that classroom teachers are ill-prepared to supervise such staff. What's more, the researcher said that one-to-one engagement may be the result of a fragmented service system in which it's often unclear who is responsible for training, supervising, and evaluating these employees. An ongoing debate over the sub-minimum wages paid to workers with disabilities erupted into a scuffle between law enforcement and protesters last week at the state capitol grounds in Lansing, Michigan. Police arrested blind protester Joe Hartz, age 62, of Mount Morris, Michigan, who was informed by what he noted was ironically a termed a police courtesy call, that he will be charged with a felony. Hart said that the Michigan State Police used police state tactics when, as he and other protesters tell it, they prevented Hart's and others from entering and challenging with signs, T-shirts, and chants a commemoration of the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The pay of hundreds of thousands of workers with disabilities who often work in so-called sheltered workshops separate from disabled peers is subject to a section of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Unlike any other worker in the U.S., workers employed under that act are paid solely according to their productivity with literally no legal minimum wage. And finally, as a growing number of colleges offer programs for students with intellectual disabilities, a new report provides the most comprehensive look yet at who's attending and their outcomes. The federally mandated report out this month from the Think College National Coordinating Center at the University of Massachusetts in Boston offers a snapshot of what's happening at post-secondary programs across the country using data solicited from 50 programs that receive funding from the U.S. Department of Education. 883 students attending federally funded post-secondary programs in 2013-14, 39% had a paid job. However, the report noted that the longer students were enrolled, the more likely they were to be employed. Among those in their fourth year, more than three-quarters were working a paid job, internship, or participating in other career development activities. By comparison, only 30% of students engaged in post-secondary programs during the 2010-11 academic year had jobs that paid, according to Meg Griggle, co-director of Think College and an author of the report. Ultimately, about 40% of those who exited programs in 2014 left with a paid job. Individuals who attended the programs as adults were more likely than those duly enrolled in high school to have paid employment when they moved on from the post-secondary programs, the report found. Griggle said, quote, the growing percentage of students leaving these programs with paid employment demonstrates the capacity of higher education to serve as a viable pathway to employment for people with intellectual disability, end quote. Slightly more than half of students took courses specifically designed for and limited to the post-secondary programs, while the remainder participated in general college coursework alongside their typically developing peers. The report authors noted that increasing access to inclusive course offerings remains a challenge. And that's the news for this week. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by my guest on the phone, Kenneth Ditkowski. Kenneth is an attorney from Chicago, and was contacted about Kenneth and invited him to be on the program to talk about issues around guardianship, both for people with disabilities and for people who are elderly. So welcome to the program, Kenneth.
Hi. My situation involving guardianship arises out of a case called In re Mary Sykes, 09P4585, out of Cook County. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit of the open secret or the secret that exists about guardianship and how guardianship has become a white-collar crime of immense proportions. Still there?
Yes. Are you?
Immense proportions that is literally robbing many elderly people of their savings, of everything that they have. It isolates them, it abuses them, it exploits them, and ultimately causes them to be killed. I refer to the killing as assisted involuntary suicide, and the entire process is called elder cleansing. And what you basically have is you have a lady like Mary Sykes who's railroaded into a guardianship. They don't even bother to comply with the Illinois statutes. They just find that she's incompetent. They take away her money. They take away her liberty. They separate her from her family. And ultimately, after they've exhausted all her money, she just dies. And I believe at one point in time you had her daughter in, who talk to you about this problem as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have talked over the course of years on this program about guardianship and particularly as it impacts people with developmental disabilities. And in our world, in the world of developmental disabilities, it seems that guardianship is almost a given, that at age 18, parents just go out and get guardianship over their family member with a disability. And it's very, very hard to get that taken away once
it's given. Well,
it's
true. In the case of the elderly, you have a guardianship statute which complies with ADA. ADA requires that's Title II, requires that they make a reasonable accommodation. And if you look at 755 ILCS 5/3B, let's see if I got that right anyway. It's Section 3B, it's 11A-5-3B, mm-hmm. which says that the guardianship is only for the purpose of providing the disabled person with what they can't provide themselves, which translates into a reasonable accommodation. And what happened in the Mary Sykes case was they never even bothered the hearing. They just decided to provide a guardian. The guardian took over every aspect of her life, where she lived, who she talked to, what church she went to, if any. They put her in a daycare facility where she was drugged and literally made into a zombie, and then they walked away with everything she had. She had about $1 million in gold coins. That disappeared. She had a house that had been appraised at $700,000. They sold it for $200,000+. And, of course, they sold it to a related person. And Mary wound up with nothing. In a case in Florida, the guardian actually had the temerity to try and annul the marriage between the disabled person and his wife. The man had a serious automobile accident. And the Florida court decided that she ought to have a guardian. So, bingo. The guardian was appointed. The wife objected. The wife didn't like what was going on, didn't like the treatment. So the guardian goes into court and says the marriage ought to be annulled, and the judge enters an order trying to annul the marriage. She went to the appellate court, and they reversed it. But that didn't change it. In Florida, you also have the Barbara Stone case. Barbara Stone came in, saw her mother. Her mother asked for food. She realized that her mother had been placed on a feeding tube at the direction of the guardian, not the direction of anybody else. And the court was enforcing it. Barbara objected. They arrested her, and she actually spent some time in jail. So, and you go, the outrages go on and on. I believe you talked to Janet Phelan, who's a journalist in California, and she told you what happened to her mother and how she literally had to run out of the state. This is the dirty little secret we have to deal with. If a party objects, that party can expect to have a problem. If in Illinois that party objects, you're going to have the ARDC, the Attorney Discipline Commission, go after your license. I asked for an honest investigation of this thing, and I wound up with district proceedings and a 4-year suspension. Had I stole Mary's money, I would have gotten less. Joanne Dennison did exactly the same thing, and she just got a 3-year suspension. In Arizona, an attorney by the name of, I think it's Grant Goodman, got a suspension or disbarment and got substantial sanctions brought against him for objecting to this situation. This is what we're facing. We're facing a regular assault on the civil liberties of not only the disabled, but anybody who objects to it. When you talk to Gloria Sykes, she can tell you about the beating she received. She got some real marks and bruises, and the state's attorneys of Cook County took the case but never prosecuted it. So, and it goes on and on.
So I have a question for you, Kenneth. How prevalent is this kind of thing? How many people? I know it's pretty widespread.
Hundreds. The GAO, the Government Accounting Office, has 4 studies on it. Nothing comes of it.
And are these guardians appointed by the court, or are they
family? They're appointed by the court.
Okay.
And in the Mary Sykes case, the guardian should never have been appointed. All the protections of the Constitution are contained in Section 10 of it. Nothing was complied with. You're supposed to serve summons. The sheriff of Cook County told us there was no summons served. The summons has to be a particular type. The clerk of the court doesn't even have that form, or didn't have the form. And certainly it wasn't complied with. There has to be 14 days prior notice given to family members. You know what happened in the Sykes case? They didn't bother.
Wow.
They didn't even have a hearing. There's an email from one of the guardian ad litem to Gloria Sykes telling her they didn't have to have a hearing. the two guardian ad litem got together with the attorney for the person seeking to be a guardian, and they handed the judge a agreed order. The judge signed it, totally taking away all Mary's rights, totally ignoring ADA, totally ignoring the statute, totally ignoring Article 1 of the Illinois Constitution, totally ignoring the United States Constitution. And they go on and on. And the Attorney Discipline Commission says they're part of a cover-up. They say, well, the family had knowledge. But what do they have knowledge of? They didn't have prior knowledge of any hearing, and there wasn't any hearing.
So let me ask a question. So if I have a parent, and, you know, in fact, I do have a mom who is currently in assisted living. If I am not her guardian, how does that happen? What is the process?
Does it happen? Well, the court has discretion as to who to pick the guardian. And usually they come up with the idea when the guardian comes in and says, she agitates her mother. And the judge looks in horror and says, agitates her mother? We've got to have somebody who's a neutral. So they pick a neutral. And the neutral is like the receivers that were handled in the 50s. That guardian comes in, takes over everything, takes over bank accounts, takes over the life of that person,
and proceeds to liquidate the estate. How does that happen without the knowledge of the family? Is it
The family does have knowledge that's going on, but the family can't do anything. When the family goes to court, the family is told, you don't have jurisdiction. We can't hear you. In the Alice Gore case, the family objected to the treatment, and they went to the owner of the nursing home she was in, that Alice was in, and they said, how can this happen? How can you do such a thing? He says, I can do it because I can do it. And they took, I believe it was 80 pounds of silver coins disappeared, never inventoried. They took and pulled 29 teeth to get at the gold fillings the lady had. Nothing the family could do about it. When they finally killed her, the family didn't know for a bunch of days.
Was this homicide?
In my opinion, it certainly has to be investigated. Of it, my problem, I got suspended for 4 years for demanding an honest investigation. I was actually asked on the stand by an ARDC attorney if I was repentant for writing the Attorney General of the United States. Of course, I wasn't. And I'm not. I'm fighting.
So what can people do to help combat this issue?
Well, one of the things they have to do is they have to keep at law enforcement and make it politically unacceptable for these things to occur. We have an ARDC that is engaged in a full cover up.
And what is the ARDC?
Attorney Registration Discipline Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly are violating 18 U.S.C. 371 and 18 U.S.C. 242. And this creates a very interesting situation which people can push. The breach of fiduciary relationship, i.e. the bad conduct by a guardian, is a taxable event. Under Section 371 of the Federal Code, the standard for being a conspirator is laid out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're a conspirator, if you and I conspire to do something, and we do it intentionally, it's an intentional tort and it's an intentional crime, we have joint and several liability. This means we have joint and several liability for the taxes due. So when the ARDC engages in this, Attorney Discipline Commission, engages in this type of situation, or even the Supreme Court engages in this type of situation, where they violate the 14th Amendment, the 5th Amendment, and the 1st Amendment, as well as Article 1 of the Illinois Constitution. They have not only liability for the crime and the civil losses, but they have tax liability. Mm-hmm. And the state of Illinois is on the verge of bankruptcy. The amounts of money that have been stolen here by guardians, i.e., in particular, that which hasn't been inventoried, the $1 million from the Sykes case, the $8 million from the Tyler case, the couple $1 million from the Gore case. All this money is taxable money, and taxes are due to the federal government as well as the state government. And they're due from every one of the co-conspirators. They have joint several liability. If the state went out to collect this money, they put a damper on it. It'd make it impractical.
Mm-hmm.
The guardian who took and prospected for gold in Alice Gore's mouth should at least pay the taxes on the gold that was taken out of there.
How prevalent would you say this is of, you know, say all people in Illinois who do have guardians? What percentage of those do you suspect are cases of abuse?
I don't know the percentage, but it's too large, and it's way, way too large a percentage, because the number of people I've heard from and people who've written to the various blogs is enormous. Just about every day, Joanne Dennison is getting on her blog, Mary Sykes, letters from people who are aggrieved by this type of thing. In Florida, it looks like it's an epidemic. The number of people involved is incredible.
Yeah. It sounds like it. So where can people go?
It's terrible. It's frightening. It's frightening because it can happen to you. You know, it's stroke. And there's a problem. You have a complicated estate.
And you think people who are wealthy,
maybe the public guardian comes in and wants it, or the nursing home they're involved, or the doctor wants it.
And people who are wealthier are more susceptible to this kind of abuse, yes?
And when you get to elderly people, the husband dies, leaving the wife vulnerable. A family fight can result in this. Two members of the family fight over the estates, and mom is left there, and they want to get a hold of mom's estate, so one of them goes and finds the right attorney, and bingo.
So where can people go to learn more about this issue, Kenneth?
They can go to Probate Sharks has a blog that has a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
The National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse has a blog which has a lot of information on it. The Mary G. Sykes has a lot of information on it. There's one ran across yesterday, was called Ugly Judge. Apparently they have a lot of it. Janet Phelan has written numerous articles in connection with this. And GAO reports have a lot of information in connection with it.
Okay, well, I'll be sure and get that information out on the website. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks for bringing our attention to this important issue.
Oh, Kenneth, you're certainly welcome. Anytime.
Kenneth Ditkowski, attorney from Chicago on guardianship and abuse. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com, or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.